We're going to do the hearing on the work session on 2143 first, and then we'll get to you just as quickly as we can. This 3329 should be pretty quick. 2143 should be quick. So, Mr. Wilson, if you'd like to tee it up.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, in front of you is a memo from me on House Bill 2143, Tobacco Settlement Funds. What this bill does is generally, as you may know, we had a master settlement agreement with major tobacco companies. One of the provisions of that agreement and law that you passed probably two biennia ago, I'm not sure of the date of it, was enforcement actions around non-participating manufacturers. These were the folks that did not participate as part of a master settlement agreement. There are specific enforcement actions that must take place outlined in statute, and statute also transfers $700,000 of biennium under current law to the Department of Justice for these enforcement efforts. Unfortunately, $700,000 was a figure that was put in a previous biennium, and costs don't keep up with that. The budget you passed out the Department of Justice a week or so ago assumes about $924,000, I believe, in expenses. So what this bill does is remove that $700,000 limit and puts in a process with DAS, Department of Justice, indirectly the legislature, and setting the amount that is transferred from that fund for this purpose every biennium. It also, the other function of the bill is to set the dates in a different way. Right now, the payments are made retrospectively, and for cash flow purposes for the department, it's best to make those prospectively. So that is the other thing that the bill does. This is passed out of House Judiciary Committee, I believe, back in February. And now that we've passed the Department of Justice budget, it's time to move this forward. The fiscal is also in your packet. That fiscal reflects the DOJ budget you passed out. The $228,000 of other funds is part of that budget. And the amendment that you have, 2143-A2, allows a process before they would have had to estimate all their costs at the beginning of the biennium. This allows them to, if they come across a major case that they need to work on regarding non-participating manufacturers, it allows them to go back to the Department of Justice or Department of Administrative Services and request additional funds. The legislature's participation is similar to all limitation restraints. The legislature does put limitations on how much the department can spend out of other funds, and so that's the role. If the department found they needed more than what they originally got in the budget, they would have to come back to the E-Board to get authority for the limitation side of that. And we also, the amendment also takes out a provision in the original bill that if the bill had passed before June 1, there was language in there anticipating that. We are past June 1, unfortunately approaching July 1, so we don't need that provision anymore. So, Mr. Chair, that is my quick and dirty presentation, and we would need to move the amendment.
Good. I think it would be my preference to keep I don't think any of the agency needs to weigh in, but if there's any member of the public that came to testify specifically on this bill, we would welcome. Good. Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, are we in a public hearing or a work session?
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2143 and open a work session on House Bill 2143. Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the -A2 amendments to House Bill 2143.
Representative Nathanson has moved the -2 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objections?
Can we discuss the -2? I know Representative Barker and I heard this bill in Judiciary quite a while ago. What are the -2s? Two versus
Mr. Chair, is the
bill?
Difference between the two, the original bill or the A and Gross that passed out of Judiciary and this one, there are two things. One of them is to set up a process so if part of the way through the biennium, they come across some extraordinary reason to needing further funds for this function, they can come back. There's a process that allows them to do that. It would also indirectly require the emergency board or the legislature for that. And the other thing it does is take out language that is no longer needed. Because it's after June 1st, the bill included some language that's no longer needed.
Thank you.
Any objections? So moved. Senator Wilkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2143A as amended to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Nathanson has moved House Bill 2143 as amended to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So moved. Carrier, Representative Nathanson, you did so well on that. Perhaps you could carry that in full for us.
Okie dokie.
Great. And then Senator Burdick on the Senate side. Thank you. Okay. We will close the work session on House Bill 2143 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3329. And we'll have staff tee it up, and then Representative Gelser and Representative Smith, if you can come forward.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, House Bill 3329 enhances the penalties for the crime of strangulation and punishes by a maximum of 5 years imprisonment and $125,000 fine or both. It moves a crime of strangulation from a misdemeanor to a Class C felony. And we also have some amendments in your packet. And those amendments will take out a piece of this that kind of casts too broad of a net. But by doing that, we're not necessarily getting rid of any convictions or prosecutions that we might normally see the way it was written. So we feel that that's a good compromise, and I'll let the representatives speak to the bill itself.
Welcome to the committee. Who would like to go first?
Thank you. I'm Patty Smith, State Representative, District 52. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this important bill and the committee members. And I want to thank Representative Gelser for all the work.
Could you move the mic a little closer to you, Representative Smith? Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me now? I think I sound like a commercial. I'm here today to support House Bill 3329, an important piece of legislation that I'm proud to co-sponsor. In 2003, we made strangulation a misdemeanor, and now it is time for us to strengthen this law and make it a felony offense. Strangulation as a misdemeanor is not enough, and as a result, many have endured repeat offenses, battering, stalking, and for some, death. The crime of strangulation should be upgraded to a felony, not only to save lives, but to put an end to this violence that is called domestic violence. I've handed out my written testimony, and so I won't read it. I just want to tell you how important this bill is, and I am very pleased to sponsor it. I think it's important that we change the offense. Like I said, we did it in 2003. We need to strengthen it. We need to make it a felony offense, and I'm here to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I'm also here to testify in support of House Bill 3329, which I'm co-sponsoring with Representative Smith, which has been a very fun experience. This will extend critical protections to victims of domestic violence in Oregon by enhancing the crime of strangulation to a felony in certain circumstances. I was very surprised to learn that strangulation currently is only a misdemeanor in all cases, and was even more surprised when I learned that strangulation had not even been its own separate crime until 2003. Strangulation is one of the most common acts of violence against women in domestic violence situations and in the commission of rape. Unconsciousness can occur within 10 to 60 seconds, and death can occur within a matter of minutes. When the victim does not die, this act can cause internal injuries that can lead to brain damage and, in some cases, even death days after the commission of the crime. Domestic violence experts know that when an abuser uses strangulation as a method of control, it is often an indicator that the situation is often likely to become fatal. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the two amendments and what the circumstances are that would make this enhancement to a felony, and we have several advocates here today to talk to you a little bit about why they support this bill as well. If 3329 passes, strangulation would be a Class C felony if the crime was committed in the presence of a minor child. If the person used, attempted to use, or threatened to use a deadly or a dangerous weapon while committing the crime, if the person had previously been convicted of felony strangulation, or if the person had been convicted previously of person-on-person violent crimes against the same victim that was victimized by this act of strangulation, or had three previous convictions on a combination of those domestic violence-related crimes in other jurisdictions. The amendments do two things. You have the dash ones and the dash twos. The dash twos are incorporated in the dash ones. So I'd like to start with the dash twos, which is backwards. And what that does, if you look on the printed bill in line 18, it removes the person caused physical injury to the victim while committing the crime from the bill. And the reason for this is that that drove a relatively large fiscal on this bill. If an individual has a physical injury, that crime can be charged as assault because of that demonstration of physical injury. So removing this does not lessen penalties for perpetrators. It does not leave people in more danger. It simply allows that assault charge to be made and helps to make this an affordable proposal. And the dash two does that. The dash one does that and does some other cleanup that we found after this passed unanimously out of the Judiciary Committee. One is that in line 16 of the printed bill in regards to the weapon, the printed bill reads dangerous weapon. It really should be deadly or dangerous weapon. It was not our intent to leave out guns and knives. It also, if you look at Section E of the printed bill, Section F talks about in other jurisdictions. We want to be sure that if one of these crimes was committed against the same victim in another state, that also was enough to enhance that. That was something that we had overlooked there. And we wanted to put in a definition of what strangulation witnessed by a child is, and you can see that in lines 14 to 16 of the amendments. This is a very good bill. It's very important to many domestic violence prevention advocates. It will strengthen the ability to put some very dangerous people behind bars for a period of time that will provide protection to their victims, and I hope that you will consider passage during this session of this bill, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, both of you, for bringing this bill forward. Question, you mentioned the fiscal is too large to leave a physical injury. I don't have any fiscal numbers in front of me. Is there any fiscal numbers that have been done on this bill?
A good question, Representative Cameron. I think we have some ballpark figures, but I don't think it's been completed.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Representative Cameron, we've done some preliminary work, but I've not released a formal fiscal impact statement. The bill, as originally written, the fiscal impact was large, and the fiscal impact, if the bill is push forward with the proposed amendments, it's smaller. I'm being a little coy just because I don't want to throw out any numbers that I haven't had time to confirm, but I think as amended, then we have a better chance of having a good discussion about moving it forward with the co-chairs.
I respect that. And Mr. Chair, if I may follow up. Large is, I was building a house one time, and my wife kept saying that the contractor said it would be too expensive to do a raised bar on the granite countertop.
Yes.
And I asked her, I said, he keeps saying too expensive, it would cost too much, get a number from him. And it was $800 more over the lifetime of the house that I was building. And so his perception of what large was different. So can we get a number that we might think is too large, or approximate number?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, the large number, you would have a fairly substantial house. It's between $6.5 and $7 million a biennium. And that is just the prison bed impact and parole and post-prison supervision and the community corrections. That wouldn't include any other costs from judicial department or the DAs or anyone else. The number as amended is between 750 and a million a biennium. So there's a substantial difference between the two. But again, those are not final numbers by any means, so we still need to do some work on them.
Oh, that's perfect. Thank you for the clarification. If I follow,
no, and I think that is helpful in the discussion. I mean, that's going to be critical if this goes to work session.
Right. And then the other thing I would like to know is when we come up with those numbers, because I don't understand the difference necessarily between a Class C felony and a Class A misdemeanor. So a person that causes physical injury under this bill would still fall under the Class A misdemeanor and would be prosecuted there, or would be prosecuted under a current statute that they would already be prosecuted under? Is that what I heard?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, I believe that's the case, and we've got some folks from the DAs, and I see Craig Prince back there from CJC nodding his head.
Maybe could we bring up Ms. Asanich? Ellen, could you come up and just comment on that? Were you the staff person on this bill?
I am Ms.
Oh. Okay, great. Thank you. If you could please come forward. Great.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might add, too, that maybe as you hear the testimony that we're going to hear from other people, your questions will be answered, too. So.
And may I, Mr. Chair, when I really appreciated LFO calling our offices and letting us know that there might be a large number attached. And as you all know, you get a number back that's big. You have a lot of internal responses to that. And my first was, why is it so big? And my second was, that's kind of alarming that we have that many people out there strangling people that this enhancement would create a problem for. So certainly I would not have come to you supporting something that would have left people sitting out there. And I'm comfortable after my conversations with Ellen that this would pick people up in other kinds of ways while allowing us to move forward with the strangulation enhancements.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
You know, I would have to echo Ms. Gelser. If the fiscal impact is such, that says to me that we have a lot of individuals out there who have gotten off or who should have been in that wasn't. So, I mean, I'm glad that you pushed for those numbers. I think it's for us to make some decisions relative to whether or not we want to go forward or not on a policy issue. So thank you, Representative Cameron, and thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for sitting
at the table. Ms. Skinner? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Shields. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I have been prosecuting domestic violence crimes primarily for the last 10 years. And I was actually involved in the original drafting of the bill back in 2003 on the committee that came up with the language for this to be a misdemeanor. So this has been an issue that's been close to work that I've been doing with the Oregon District Attorney Association for quite some time. When we testified previously on this bill, we had Jennifer Schindel, who's a registered nurse, who's able to provide some medical testimony. And I've also worked in the past with Chris Karcher, who's a medical examiner from Coos County, on this issue when we drafted the original bill. And I just wanted to summarize briefly some information that they would have been able to provide that I've also taken from materials that have been published by Assistant City Attorney Gail Streck, and Dr. George McLean, who's an ER doctor. That have worked all over the United States on educating on this issue of strangulation. Just that some basic information that when we're talking about strangulation under the statute currently in Oregon, we're talking about either the suffocation by the nose and mouth that prevents the breathing or the the strangulation of the throat. And the way that your neck is designed, for those of us that are not medical personnel, there are carotid arteries that are your major vessels that are transporting oxygenated blood from your heart and your lungs to your brain. These are the arteries on the sides of your neck that one would normally check to see if you have a pulse. You also have jugular veins that are the major vessels that are transporting deoxygenated blood from your brain back to your heart. Victims of strangulation can lose consciousness in a very short amount of time by any one of the following: by blocking of the carotid arteries, blocking of the jugular veins, or by closing off the airway, which causes the victim to be unable to breathe, or the causing the air not to come through the nose or the mouth. As we've heard, the medical testimony is that it takes only 11 pounds of pressure placed on both sides of your carotid arteries for 10 seconds to lose unconsciousness. And to completely close off your trachea with pressure, it takes three times as much, 33 pounds, but that brain death will occur in 4 to 5 minutes if strangulation continues and that pressure is not relieved. Damage can be caused, ultimately, as I've just pointed out, by actual death from that amount of time passing, but also you can have damage that's internal. You can have damage to your larynx cartilage, your hyoid bone, which is all cartilage that's contained inside of your throat. This can ultimately swell because something can crack or something can break or something can tear, which swells, and up to 36 hours later, victims have been documented to have died in their sleep, have been died after they've been seen by police officers or maybe the case was not even reported to the police because they didn't show any outside injuries, but they have this internal swelling. You can also have internal bleeding from damage inside of your throat. Strangulation also causes involuntary urination, defecation, and there have been many cases of documented miscarriages that have occurred up to several days or weeks after, or up to a week after the incident. You can also get lung damage by inhaling blood or vomit that results as from being strangled, and this can cause pneumonia. This can cause a natural reaction where your lungs actually start filling up with fluid, and that for, again, a period of days, you can actually suffocate from the fluid that fills up your lungs, or the pneumonia-type symptoms. And finally, you can get brain damage from all the things that occur from the strangulation can cause brain damage that can take that can just either impair the person so they will never be as they were before, or they can actually die up to several weeks after the incident. So those are just some of the basic information medically that we want you to understand about why, generally speaking, that we find strangulation to be such an important issue for prosecution. As far as it relates to these issues that are before you today, as far as the enhancement under certain circumstances, and when you look at the progression of domestic violence generally, and I'm speaking referring back to the studies that were done, again, by Gail Streck and George McLean, and also my experiences of having prosecuted these cases for over 10 years, often domestic violence doesn't start with strangulation. It starts with pushing and shoving and controlling behaviors that escalate into more violence. And what the kinds of violence that we see at the end of the spectrum, the serious cases where people, there's high lethality, is strangulation and the use of weapons. Because if you think about an act of strangulation, it's a very close, upfront, personal, it's very controlling, it's very threatening. It's a message that I can kill you at any moment. I may choose not to right now, but if you don't comply with all the things that I want you to do, that is what's going to happen, and that's what makes it so dangerous. The aggravators that are on this bill all either involve the increase of lethality based on studies that have been done, or lethality scales, or the effect on other people. When looking at the increase enhancement for prior convictions of either this crime or other listed domestic violence crimes, the study, again, done by Gail Streck and George McLean, they did a study of 300 strangulation cases. And in their study, there was a documented history of domestic violence in 89% of all the strangulation cases that they had looked at in their study. So it is definitely an action that occurs after there's been a buildup of a long documented history of domestic violence. When you look at most lethality assessments, And I just brought along one, a danger assessment. And I know that we'll have police officer testimony to this issue in a few minutes. But often lethality assessments are done to determine how dangerous a domestic violence offender is at different stages of the case, maybe by the police, maybe by a probation officer, maybe by a prosecutor, maybe by an advocate, to determine how much of a risk of death is this victim at. And three of the things that are commonly looked at in lethality assessments are the severity and frequency of previous domestic violence events, was a weapon ever used or threatened to be used, and was the victim ever strangled. Those are the issues, again, we're looking at is trying to isolate the people that really are causing the most risk to victims. And then when looking at children as witnesses, the same study that I referenced before, in those 300 cases, 50% of them were witnessed by children. This becomes a problem for the same reasons that we wanted to enhance the penalty for assault 4 back in 1997 because of all the problems that it causes for children to witness domestic violence. Some basic problems is that often children are hurt. The statistics show that the children are much more likely to be victims of child abuse if there is domestic violence in the home. In addition, children tend to want to intervene, and they often get injured in the process of trying to help one of the parents if they are a victim of domestic violence. And then finally, we often hear about children where one parent finally does want to kill their partner. They often kill the children, too. We hear about this all the time in the news, where they take out their partner and they take out the children because that ultimate intervention was never done. And then we hear, and we know from the cases that we hear about, and many advocates will tell you about, the children will model their parents. And many boys grow up modeling their fathers if they're the abuser. And they will grow up commonly and repeat the behaviors that they have learned at home. And we're wanting to stop that cycle of violence as soon as we can. So the enhancement... Okay, and in summary, the enhancements in this case will make it so that those cases that the offenders will be eligible to go to prison, and that the victims will be able to be safe from the abuse.
And I just want to make sure that Representative Cameron's questions were under. We need to understand the mechanics of what's it going to mean today, jail time, prison time, versus under this bill.
Assuming that this is given a level 6 on the sentencing guidelines, that was the same as what a felony assault 4 is. So, and I guess I want to be clear about your question, was that if there also was an assault, what would that mean? Currently, go ahead.
If I may, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess when we look at that fiscal, and I'm glad we had a huge number and then a not so, or the words were, large number and then a not so large number. I guess in my mind I'm trying to, you know, somebody strangles somebody, and because we're striking the line that says because they don't, or because of physical injury, my concern is that there must be a lot of people, and what are the numbers that we had to back out of people that we could convict for that crime to get down to this fiscal, and the difference, if I can't convict them now on that crime, how much time are those people going to be spending? Versus as a prosecutor, you're going to have a limited amount of people that you can prosecute under this bill, obviously. And I appreciate the bill we heard and understand that we need to be, and your testimony, and I understand we need to be strong on this particular crime because of the dangers that it possesses and the power that people have over others with this, and yet we're backing off, and I'm concerned, is it going to be... a bill that's not really going to help us.
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, I believe that the aggravators that are left will be very helpful to us. What would happen in practically is that if you did have a strangulation where there was an assault that also occurred, that person would also be charged with, the strangulation would just be a misdemeanor with the new amendments, and the assault 4 would just be a misdemeanor. Both of them would be A misdemeanors, unless that person had some other enhancement that would make either one of those a felony. So then the maximum sentence on either one of those counts would be 1 year in a local jail facility. One of the problems is that some counties have plenty of jail space, And so a year could potentially mean a year. In other counties, there is no jail space, and so a year means almost nothing. And so there's not as much equity as, you know, not as equal as it is when they're going to the Department of Corrections. I think that the reason originally that there's a distinction.
If I may interrupt, follow up. If I may interrupt, and then just for my information, if they were prosecuted under this bill, how much time would they be able to be sentenced for?
Representative Cameron, again, assuming that this is given a crime seriousness of a level 6, depending on their prior criminal record, if they have no criminal record, a very limited criminal record that only included drugs and property offenses, they'd be looking at getting probation, formal probation. If they had three prior felony persons convictions on their record, then they would be looking at 30 months. And then if the state was able to prevail on filing enhancement factors, we could get up to 60 months. So 60 months would be the maximum sentence under this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Barker.
So I just want to understand. So you and I go out and the kids aren't home, so I can choke you and cause you brain damage and I'm a misdemeanor.
Chair Shields and Representative Barker, there are other statutes when the situation is extremely aggravated, and they're in a situation like that, one might be able to charge somebody with an attempted murder or an attempted assault one or an attempted assault two. Those crimes just all prove that certain a higher level of a mental state, and we'd have to prove that the defendant was intending to cause serious physical injury or death, which is a harder thing to prove, and the circumstances would show whether we could prove that or not. But there are many situations where it's very aggravated, especially when there is serious physical injury that does result, that we could charge them with other types of felonies.
I'm just a little concerned. I mean, I know we have the money problem, but the difference between getting hurt kind of in the neck and dying is pretty close. And I can remember 40-some years ago in my Marine Corps, you know, in training, a lot of things they told me was to try and crush that. And the guy's going to die. And it doesn't take too much to do it. You know, so they said, don't do it fooling around. So you get somebody in there, you can break that down, and it'll stick together, and it'll suffocate. And, I mean, I'm very concerned that we, and we're saying, oh, geez, it costs money. Mm-hmm. So let a few women, you know, what the hell. I don't like that. I'd rather spend the money, but anyway.
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, two issues very briefly. Also, the cases that I've seen, people tend to strangle over a period of time. They do it over and over and over and over again, and it usually gets worse over a period of time as well. And so the hope, of course, is to catch them early on, and then the subsequent penalty will give them a felony that would send them to prison. Also, the original reason that the original bill of strangulation does not include the word physical injury in it is because it is so hard to prove in a normal strangulation case that somebody has actually been caused physical injury, which is impairment of their physical condition or substantial pain. Usually you don't see it. The studies show that in like 85% of the cases, you don't see anything. They're not bleeding. There's nothing to see. It's all inside. And so as far as the law goes, it's so hard for us to prove that they're injured. And so prior to this bill, often those cases, and again, excluding the extreme situation where someone resulted in serious physical injury, those cases would be charged as a harassment, which is a B misdemeanor, which really does have almost no teeth under the law as far as that goes.
Ms. Skinner, so my understanding is the difference in an assault 2 is that there's actually a weapon involved. Is that correct?
Well, an assault, Chair Shields, an assault 2 can be two things. It can either be that somebody intentionally or knowingly caused serious physical injury to somebody else, or that somebody intentionally or knowingly caused physical injury with what's called a dangerous weapon. So if somebody did, in fact, have, say, an object that they were strangling them with, and then they actually caused them physical injury, which is impairment of the physical condition or substantial pain, then that would be an assault 2, which is a ballot measure 11 offense currently, which you get a mandatory minimum of 70 months.
And then for, I assume, if those conditions were not met, it would be an assault 4. Is that what you're saying currently?
Yes.
In the statute?
Which is another discussion for another day. There is a huge gap between you're going to go from ballot measure 11 offense to a misdemeanor, and there's nothing in between.
And so the presumption with assault 4, your first time offense, is probation, is what you're saying?
Chair Shields, I think that just about any jurisdiction, unless you had a horrible record, you're going to get probation on an assault 4 conviction. You might get some jail time as a condition, but again, depending on the size of your jail and your local jurisdiction, you may not serve very much of that.
And then my last question, then I think we're going to have to move on. Yeah. Would you consider this a priority of the District Attorneys Association, or they just have a statement in support?
Chair Shields, it is a priority. This actually was our bill. We were very involved in the bill in its original genesis in 2003. The idea then was to make it a felony. Most states, this crime is a felony, but at that time, because of fiscal, our options at that point were make it a misdemeanor or it's not going to go anywhere. And so our idea was that if we can at least get it to a misdemeanor, maybe eventually when there is enough money that we might be able to add some enhancements for the areas that we feel is the most important, we might be able to add those later.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Yes. The majority of the victims in strangulation, are they male or female?
They're female. Chair Shields, Senator Winters, they are by far more female. There's very, very few female offenders for the crime of strangulation. I don't think I've ever actually seen one.
And if you were having to make a policy decision, and let's take the dollars and cents aside, but the policy decision to me is the decision of whether or not it warrants having the bill to protect and to make certain that you can prosecute. Am I correct or am I off base?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, I would definitely be in favor of that. My only fear is setting the bill up for failure, that too high of a price tag will ultimately kill the bill, and that we would rather have half a loaf than no loaf at all. But we definitely want to have as many tools as we can possibly can to hold these very dangerous offenders accountable.
Mr. Chair, it's not the first time that this body has sent out passed a bill across this chamber in both houses, and it's become law, and you didn't have all the dollars and resources with which to fund it.
You're absolutely right. It is not the first time. Which, in my view, explains why we have a $1.3 billion corrections budget. So. But we thank you for your testimony,
thank you.
We do need to keep rolling. You can continue to work with Representative Gelser, and we can figure out a way that if we're going to prioritize this, maybe we look at some other ways to offset it. Let's bring up Mr. Belshaw. Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, before Mr. Belshaw, I'm sorry, there's someone who came from Jackson County, Tira.
Good afternoon. My name is Tira LaRue, and I'm the Program Manager of Sexual Assault Victim Services at Community Works in Medford. I'm here representing Community Works as well as the Jackson County Council Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. In addition to my testimony that I'm going to share with you verbally, I've submitted testimony on behalf of the Jackson County Council and from a local therapist who treats victims of domestic and sexual violence. So I've been working with victims of domestic and sexual violence in some capacity for about 12 years. During this time, I've heard over 3,000 stories of violence and victimization. Today, I'd like to share with you a few of the excerpts from the stories of Oregon survivors of strangulation. We had a number of survivors who actually wrote letters and wanted me to be able to come and speak on their behalf. The first is from a survivor who was recalling when her husband had strangled her over 30 years ago. When I asked her to write about the experience, she told me that her throat constricted and the horror was still with her after all of those years. These are her words. It came fast and was the most terrifying experience of my life. Oh my God, I'm going to die this time. I am scared. I am pleading. I am praying. I am on my knees. But I am very quiet. I do not want my children to hear me die. Now it hurts to breathe and I can no longer speak. But I can pray. I don't know why it stopped, but I was fortunate and only had to wear turtlenecks for a short time this time. The second is from a young woman who was strangled by her partner only 2 years ago. These are her words. There were times when he would hold me down and pin me to the ground. When I tried to fight and get out of his grip, he would put his hands on my throat, strangling me to keep me on the ground. He would threaten me to do what he said, or I would see what would happen. As incidents like this went on, they kept getting worse. I was more and more afraid of him. I did not know if one of these days would be my last. I thought that he would kill me. The third wrote this after receiving assistance from an advocate in seeking a restraining order. These are her words.
He came in behind me and grabbed me by the throat. He told me while he was choking me that if I ever left him, he would kill me. Then he let go of me. I coughed and gasped for air. He had threatened to kill me in the past if I ever left him. I knew now that he would. The very last is from a woman who still has an ongoing civil case with her abuser. These are her words. He didn't punch her or hit her. He just held her down on the bed and wrapped his hands around her throat. He looked her right in the eye and leaned into her throat with all of his body weight. She tried to push him off or wriggle out from underneath him. She tried to pry his hands off from around her neck. 3 days later, there were red marks on her throat. Peggy's voice was raspy, and she had little red dots on her face and in her eyes. She said she had had a sore throat since waking up. These women all lived in fear and believed they were going to die at the hands of their attackers. Strangulation is an all-too-common tactic used by offenders to gain control and immediate compliance of victims of both domestic and sexual violence. Victims of strangulation report being terrified that they were going to die and disbelief that the offender was able to look them in the eye, cut off their airflow, and watch them as they gasped for breath. On behalf of these four survivors and hundreds of others, the residents of Jackson County ask that you support House Bill 3329. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. If you have any questions, I'm available to answer.
Thank you very much for your testimony, particularly coming so far.
My pleasure.
Obvious that this is a critical bill for the people that you're working with. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Let's see. Bring up Mr. Belshaw now. It's a public hearing.
Good afternoon, Chairman Shields and committee members. My name is Steve Belshaw. I'm Deputy Chief of Police for the Salem Police Department here in Salem, Oregon. I supervise our Criminal Investigations Unit and our Domestic Violence Response Team. Domestic violence should not happen to anybody. No child should witness their parents physically fighting. No son should have to intervene between his father and mother to keep his father from physically assaulting his mother. No daughter should ever have to help her mother cover up bruises with makeup so she can leave home to go to work. Yet that happens every day in the city of Salem. Every 9 seconds in the United States, a man strikes a woman in a criminal act. Last year in Salem, our advocates and officers provided services to over 650 women who were the victims of domestic violence. In Salem, of all the types of assaults our officers see, the most potentially lethal assault is strangulation. Yet the crime of strangulation is probably the most under-recognized assault we have on the books. Our officers are trained to look at cuts and bruises and stab wounds and gunshot wounds, and this leaves very little marks. Once we trained our officers about what to look for, our strangulation arrests went way up. Since January 1st, 2004, we've investigated 384 strangulation cases and made 290 arrests. 76 of those arrests were for other violent crimes. 12 had been previously arrested for strangling their domestic partner. We teach our officers that the crime of strangulation is not about anger, it's not about frustration, it's not about intoxication. It's about power and control. What more effective way to demonstrate that you are in control of another person than to put your hands around their throat and restrict their airflow? As a new police officer, I was taught that when you had a person that would not comply with your lawful orders, you put your hands around their throat and you controlled their behavior. We learned very early on in law enforcement that that was very dangerous and people died from doing that. As a result, now the carotid control hold in law enforcement is right below, on the use of force continuum, the use of your handgun. It is that high because it is that dangerous. The only reason you put your hands around another person's throat is to control them. It's not a sign of affection, and it doesn't lead to anything positive. We teach our officers to look at these cases as cases of attempted murder. When we look at our lethality risks, we look at strangulation and the use of weapons as significant violent steps towards a homicide, and that's how we treat these. Our policy and practice is now if a victim says she has been strangled, we will have a medic respond every time to check on their physical well-being. The only way to effectively break the cycle of domestic violence is to hold offenders accountable for their action. Since we formed our domestic violence team in 1999, our domestic violence-related homicides have dropped steadily, and now we have not had a domestic violence-related homicide since 2003 because we hold offenders accountable. Due to our excellent working relationship with our Marion County District Attorney's Office, cases investigated by our domestic violence officers, 99% of them were filed for criminal charges. I know one of the things you must look at is the economic impact of this bill. I would submit not holding offenders accountable is much more costly. Domestic violence costs in the U.S. economy is estimated at $3 to $5 billion annually in job absenteeism and another $100 million in medical costs. We were the first state to have mandatory arrests in domestic violence. I would submit passing this bill would show that the state of Oregon is still the leader in holding domestic violence offenders accountable for their actions.
Thank you, Mr. Belshaw. I'm going to ask to hold questions because I've got to leave the committee shortly, but so I want to get through as many people as we can. Thank you very much for your testimony.
I know, just real quick, Mr. Chair, this is an important question. Would you support the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments that we've heard about today?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. And I think what we may have to do is bring the people who are locally back tomorrow because we will be meeting tomorrow from 2:30 to 4, so we might be able to take a little bit of public testimony then if the DOJ staff would like to come back. And then, Ms. Labberton, are you from Salem? Would that be okay if you came back? Great, thanks. And then, so then we have Ms. O'Mara, and you came from a bit of ways, right? So, yeah, come on up.
Are you going to be in a work session tomorrow, Mr. Chair?
On this? I don't think so. But I want to make sure that everybody's had a chance to testify.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. I did submit written testimony. You have that to look at as well. But just very briefly, I'm the Executive Director of the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Corvallis, Oregon. I've been there 5.5 years. I've worked in the field for 25 years. Those of us who have been working to keep...
For the record, could you please introduce yourself formally?
Sorry. Nancy O'Mara, the Executive Director of the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. Sorry. We have long identified strangulation as an extreme indicator of risk for lethality for victims of domestic violence. As I said, I've worked in the field 25 years, and that's been something we work with survivors on repeatedly when we're talking to them on the crisis line, when we're meeting them in the courthouse, when they're coming to shelter. I had the opportunity just a few weeks ago to look through just a handful of files and pulled these notes off of our case files. Abuser violates restraining order. Police are called. Abuser violates restraining order a second time. He strangles victim and throws her down. She sustains a fractured rib and has breathing difficulties. In another, we had a victim-year-old child, abuser all in the same room. When abuser grabs client by her neck, throws her across the room. She suffers severe neck injury from the throw and the force on her neck. And another, victim strangled by her abuser on more than 100 occasions. She knows this is how he will kill her. She wants to get away, so calls police and contacts shelter after this most recent assault. Abuser holds victim's face to pillow after he steps on her chest and assaults her. The pillow did impair the victim's breathing. As I said, I only looked at a few files to get these notes from them. We hear about the cruelty of strangulation every single day. We observe the impact of terror, the terror that this assault creates on the victim herself and also her children. And we do see the physical injuries. I believe that strangulation presents a profound risk of harm to the victim. And my concern for fatality is always higher when I hear about strangulation. I'm very much in favor of House Bill 3329, and I'm here speaking today for myself, for my coworkers, for all of us in Lynn-Benton County who work on this issue daily, and also for our survivors. Thank you.
Questions for this witness? Thank you very much. Just before you go, I just wanted to ask you a question. I too believe in the concept of this bill. In Multnomah County, as a social worker, I was very frustrated with the waiting lists in domestic violence shelters. It's outrageous. And I was just wondering if somebody wanted to get away from a perpetrator in Corvallis, do you have any, can you inform the committee how long they would have to be on a waiting list or to get the type of services they need to get away?
Well, we have budgeted every year for using motel space, so we don't turn someone away because our shelters are full. We're a small program, 14 beds in our homes, but we do, as I said, put people up in motels when they need to get out immediately. I'll also tell you that we use the shelter system. There are 35 programs that we turn to in the immediate in all of Oregon. Washington and California, we're constantly networking people around. So we're working on that because I, too, saw that years ago, that it simply wasn't acceptable to end the discussion at we don't have a space. So we're working to move people around, get them out in the moment to enhance their safety.
Thank you very much for coming to testify. And I think... I think one of the things that this committee can feel very good about, too, is that we were able to get another $1 million into the Department of Justice budget, bringing them up to 4.5, and then there are also some funds in DHS that are, but I think this is an important issue to address as well. And we can continue the topic with a couple more testimonies tomorrow, and I wanted to let people know we're meeting from 2:30 to 4, again, to reiterate that. Is there anybody who's not going to be here? I'm not sure if we're voting on a bill or not at this point.
We will have floor all day in the Senate, so
okay.
I assume that's getting taken into account.
And then, unfortunately, I just found out that it can't be changed. We're going to have hearing from 1 to 2:30 on Saturday, and so I understand Representative Hannah might not be able to make it. Barker will be gone. Representative Cameron.
Public hearing or work session?
I'm not sure. I think we certainly need to have a quorum just in case. Were you planning to be here on Saturday? Because if, well, let me close the
call the chair,
and we can discuss this.